following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives. Join us next week when the regular host will be back with a few new episodes of original programming.
Welcome to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dustin Rogers, and today on the program, Gimmick for the Nintendo Entertainment System, or to be more accurate, for the Famicom. That's right, this one only came out in Japan. It was basically panned on release, but the intervening 30 years have been much kinder to it. It's gone to be much better appreciated today, especially the soundtrack by composer Masashi Kageyama. And it benefits from a special sound chip that was only ever used once, and it's here on Gimmick. It gives the 8-bit soundtrack a huge boost. We're going to listen to it all hour. There's so much to get into. Subscribe to the podcast and settle in for another episode of Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Song is called Good Morning. It was composed by Masashi Kageyama and programmed by Naoshiya Murata for the Sunsoft platformer called Gimmick, released on January 31st, 1992 on the Famicom. If Gimmick doesn't ring any bells for you, I don't blame you. Initially, the game was only ever released in Japan. North American and European versions were planned, and there's a playable prototype of the US version out there, but it was never greenlit for production. Apparently, Sunsoft of America, that's the arm of the company responsible for bringing their Japanese-developed games to the West, they didn't believe in the cutesy character design aesthetic, which was very much in the style of a Kirby game. You know, everything looks a little squishy and cute. Everything's adorable, even the enemies. This is the era that gave rise to Sonic the Hedgehog, remember. Gimmick's appeal was likely going to be too narrow to find success at the time. To add to that, by 1992, the NES was ancient technology. The Famicom, I mean, technically the same equipment, but it had been on the market even longer. Gimmick was released 9 years on from the Famicom's launch. The Super Nintendo had already been out in Japan for more than a year. And if you compare Gimmick to Super Mario World, a launch title for that system, visually it's just no contest. Mario's game was already out for 14 months. Here comes Gimmick. Even if it had come out in North America, it's hard to imagine the game finding much success here. And more than anything, those visuals that I talked about, the cutesy visuals, they were probably intended to appeal to a younger generation of kids. And that would have really made sense, except that this game is hard. It's really hard. And even by the standards of the time, it's hard. It's not uncommon to lose a life on the first screen. No kid is going to make it through Gimmick's challenging world to reach the end, which is a shame because the game is filled with fantastic music, and most of it went unheard by players outside of the sound test menu. And it didn't help that reviews slammed the game too. Electronic Gaming Monthly gave Gimmick an average of 5 out of 10. The Japanese magazine Famitsu, which is famously accurate in its review scores, gave the game 26 out of 40. A lot of these reviews cited the visuals as being a downfall of the game, but they're actually fantastic. They worked really hard to get this game to look this good, and it looks incredible on the NES, but they don't hold a candle to the Super Nintendo or the Sega Genesis. And it was never going to, but that was the competition at the time. I do want to say here that there was a small European release that saw this game release under the title Mr. Gimmick. That was in Scandinavian countries, and it was thanks to the Swedish distributor Bergsala. But that didn't happen until 1993. That's an additional 17 months on from the release date that I'm talking about. So believe me when I say this isn't a game that many people took notice of, especially here in North America, where pre-internet media landscape tended to leave games like Gimmick on the shelf in lieu of more exciting, maybe mascot-driven set pieces of the era. And that's really a shame, because Masashi Kageyama delivered a standout performance when he composed Gimmick's score. We heard the song Good Morning a few moments ago, and it really is a song in the traditional sense. There's no loop. Instead, it changes and grows in the minute and 20-second duration that it has. It's a song that betrays the rest of the game's city pop influences. Almost immediately, you can pick up on them. Although it's the only song on the soundtrack that's quite like this, that pop feeling permeates the game's music, making it, for my money, one of the most listenable soundtracks on the system. I even bought this one on vinyl. On that note, let's hear more of the incredible soundtrack from Gimmick, composed by Masashi Kageyama, and I'll be back to tell you everything I know about him and a lot more, too, on Square Wave on CKW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Welcome back to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM. The set you just heard came from the soundtrack to Gimmick, a game created for Nintendo's Famicom system by the company known as Sunsoft. The composer responsible for writing those tracks, Masashi Kageyama, is highly regarded today, and it's because of the music that you just heard. Actually, it's his interviews in liner notes, videos, websites over the years, because of his work on Gimmick, that I'm able to paint a relatively detailed picture of his life for you now. His birth date, Masashi Kageyama's birth date, is May 24th, 1966. And I'm not sure where he was born, but I know he spent time in Shizuoka and its surrounding towns in his teens and early 20s. It's very possible that he was born there somewhere in Shizuoka Prefecture, but I can't say for sure. Anyway, in his childhood, Kageyama says he didn't enjoy music class very much. He wasn't great with the recorder and found his teachers to be less than satisfying, and he especially disliked having to listen to music as a part of his studies. Kageyama preferred building electronic kits, and by the back half of the 1970s, he had a good understanding of circuit boards. Kageyama actually starts making his own radios and amps around this time. And do you know what Kageyama hears when he turns on his radio? Yeah, that's right. It's not a trick question. He heard music, specifically Western crossover music. And suddenly, Masashi Kageyama is this big music fan. By the end of 1978, heading into 1979, Kageyama is hanging out in record stores. He's around 12, 13. And he was buying the latest, you know, Olivia Newton-John album or George Benson album or Chicago album. And he spies Art Pepper's No Limit album. And he thinks, this looks pretty neat. I'm going to buy it. So he takes it home and he listens to it for the first time, and he says that the second song on the album, titled Ballad of the Sad Young Men, it completely opens his eyes to the power of the alto saxophone. He recalls that it gave him goosebumps. And just that quick, Kageyama says that he knew the alto sax was his instrument. Around this time, the song Country by Keith Jarrett was also popular on the stations that Kageyama tuned his radio to. And when he brought home Jarrett's album, it's called My Song, he says it was the piano that surprised him the most this time. And these two albums, No Limit and My Song, both jazz albums, they are what Kageyama says were responsible for turning him from a music student into a budding jazz musician over the next couple of years. Okay, we're going to fast forward just a little bit now. Kageyama is in his early 20s, and he's still learning to master the alto sax. One day, he goes with his teacher to a recording studio where they're recording the music for a commercial, but they only recorded the saxophone part. Every other instrument in the composition was sampled. The drums and guitars, they were just synths. It was all computer-generated, except for Kageyama's teacher playing the alto sax. And when Kageyama saw this, a light goes on. He says, wow. With this, I can make complete compositions all by myself. So Kageyama does what any man in his early 20s does when he wants something real bad, and he takes out a big loan. Okay, that's not fair. In his defense, it's easy money, right? Don't need studio time. You don't even need to leave your house. There's just one small problem. Kageyama doesn't know how to use a computer. Oh, and don't forget, he couldn't play the keyboard very well either. It turns out he was running into problems way before the sequencer was even involved, the sequencer that he just borrowed a bunch of money to buy. Not so easy money after all. Kageyama figures, you gotta kill two birds with one stone here. Try to get a job working for a company that uses computers. So Kageyama starts booking all these interviews, and one of the companies ended up being the fairly popular video game developer at the time, Sunsoft. And Kageyama says that the job posting was the first time he'd heard about work composing for video games, and it offered him a way to learn to use computers and compose at the same time. So he thought, this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance, I'm going to take it. And this put Kageyama on the path to compose Gimmick. And of course, there's so much more to say about the soundtrack and the special sound chip that it featured to make it sounds. But let's take a couple of minutes here and listen to more of the Gimmick soundtrack composed by Masashi Kageyama. You're listening to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM. Welcome back to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I want to take a moment to thank you for listening to community radio and remind you that if you like this show, you can subscribe to Square Wave on your favorite podcast platform to hear every episode. And make sure to keep listening to CKUW for many other excellent volunteer-driven shows just like mine. It's a fantastic way to expose yourself to new music, much like that set of songs you just heard, all of them from the game called Gimmick, released in 1992 for the Famicom. Before the break, we examined the early life of the game's composer, Masashi Kageyama, and his formative years as a musician. When we last heard from Kageyama, it was 1988 or so. He had just accepted a job at the Tokyo branch of Sunsoft, and he set to work composing music for the company's upcoming games. In this early period, Kageyama says, he would take bike rides through Shizuoka and its surrounding towns, and as he pedaled, Kageyama would ad-lib melodies in his head to match the speed of his bike. This technique is something that he would come back to many times during his time with Sunsoft, and it's possible that some of the songs that we're playing today began on one of those bike rides. Before Gimmick, the first video game compositions from Kageyama are on Outlive and Benkei Gaiden. They're both RPGs for the TurboGrafx-16 or the PC Engine for audiences outside North America. Neither Outlive or Benkei Gaiden reviewed all that well, sadly, but the reviews I was able to read mentioned Kageyama's music as one of the game's highlights. I won't have time to play those songs on today's show, but if you want to check them out for yourself, they're not too hard to find online. Anyway, after the release of these games in 1989, Kageyama was assigned to work on Gimmick, an upcoming project from the game's director, Tomomi Sakai. Kageyama says that Sakai was an exacting leader. He sought perfection in every element of the game. From the graphics, which had hoped to compete with the Super Nintendo and actually required a larger-than-normal team to accomplish, to the movement of the game's protagonist, to the music. Everything had to be just right. And ironically, Kageyama says he was given a ton of creative freedom on this project, which he composed remotely from Tokyo, away from the rest of the team in Nagoya. Kageyama says that Sakai would send him footage of the game, and he would compose music to match the character's walking speed and the stages he saw. Whenever the two had meetings together, remember this is way before video calls or anything like that, Kageyama would have to plug his phone into his Macintosh synthesizer to let Sakai listen to the songs, but it worked. And in terms of musical direction, it's like I said, Kageyama had a lot of freedom. The only song that he received special direction on from Sakai was the game's opening track, Good Morning. Now, I already played Good Morning at the top of the hour today, but I really believe it's worth re-listening to. Everything that you've heard since then, though, that came straight from Kageyama. And of course, when Sakai heard these songs, he encouraged the composer to push the sound capabilities of the Famicom to their fullest so that every sound channel was used. When he heard this, Kageyama was happy to oblige, and he began to see the game's soundtrack like a puzzle and challenged himself to squeeze more out of the 8-bit device than he thought possible. And what resulted is, of course, one of the most impressive and enjoyable soundtracks ever released on the console. But it had some help. That's right, the music from Gimmick sounds this good in part because of a special sound chip that was embedded in every Gimmick cartridge. And this expanded sound source gives the songs a depth unlike anything else in the era. And I'll tell you how it worked, but first, let's hear more of Kageyama's incredible Gimmick score. And while you listen, take a moment to appreciate the fullness of the bass, the richness of the melody. And when I'm back, so much more to come on Square Wave on CKW 95.9 FM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. The songs you just heard belong to the Famicom game Gimmick and were composed by Masashi Kageyama in the early 90s. Now, before the break, I mentioned that this game used a special sound chip to produce its sounds. It's what gives those songs such an impressive weight, and it's a quality that other games, even games from the same developer, they often lacked this. And you know, I would never attribute the excellent sound of this game to the hardware alone. I said in the last segment, these songs all came from Kageyama, and without him, it doesn't matter how good the sound chip is if there's no music to play. Also, Kageyama wasn't responsible for programming the music. He first composed these songs using samples and then handed over his work to the sound programmer to translate into something the system could actually play. In this case, the sound programmer responsible is Naohisa Murata. And just a quick interlude on Murata. While working on Gimmick, he had recently become the former sound programmer at Sunsoft, but at the insistence of Sakai, the game's director, he was contracted to complete his work on this game. Kageyama is quick to acknowledge Murata's input too, and he says that it was a big part of making this soundtrack possible. And fortunately, Murata had the Sunsoft 5B audio chip to assist him. Okay, stick with me here. This is going to get a bit technical, but I'm going to try to break it down for you at the end. The 5B audio chip was a modified version of the Sunsoft FME7 chip, which the company used to power the advanced graphics that their games featured. The only difference between Sunsoft's FME7 and the 5B chip used here on Gimmick was the inclusion of a specially developed piece of audio hardware. This audio chip was actually a modified version of the Yamaha YM2149F chip, which was also present on the MSX2 and Atari ST platforms around the same era. Itself, the YM2149F chip, itself is a variant of the General Instruments AY38910 programmable sound generator that was commonly found in arcades in the 80s, and I've talked about both of those chips on the show before. The inclusion of this Sunsoft 5B chip allowed Kageyama and Murata three additional sound channels that output a square wave tone, as well as a noise generator and one envelope generator, which were both shared among these three additional channels. Now, it's true that not all of these features were used on the soundtrack, which is a bit of a shame because the 5B chip was only ever used on one Famicom game, Gimmick, obviously. But this chip did give the duo responsible for the game's audio a much more powerful tool set to work with. Here's what Kageyama had to say in a 2022 interview when he was asked about the chip. Quote, "The added audio hardware offers the ability to generate more sounds at once, as well as makes a wider array of tones available, which enables the music to sound more lavish than what could otherwise be achieved without that technology. The basic compositional process remains the same, but the extra instruments naturally make for richer arrangements. All of that allowed me to better recreate the music I heard in my head to a more faithful degree, I feel," unquote. And I'm glad Kageyama mentioned the music that he heard in his head there, because it certainly makes me wonder what those songs might have sounded like in his head. And I have good news for me. I don't have to wonder anymore, because in 2011, there was a release of Gimmick's soundtrack on CD that included many of the original demos that Kageyama created for the game. These likely would have been made with samples that were programmed into his Macintosh synthesizer, the same one that he would plug into the phone during his meetings with Sakai. I have a couple of these tracks to listen to now, so you can get a feel for how these songs would have sounded in Kageyama's head. You'll immediately hear the city pop and jazz fusion sound that he was pursuing, and you know there's still so much more to come on Square Wave this hour, so enjoy this look behind the curtain at this era of game composition, and come back for the final segment on the Gimmick story on CKW 95.9 FM.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Square Wave. Some truly impressive synthesized tracks by Masashi Kageyama, written for the game Gimmick, released on the Famicom in 1992. All of the music that I've played on the show today has been directly tied to the game in one way or another. It's a really fantastic soundtrack, one that has stood the test of time and even managed to rise above the fate of the game that contained it to be widely beloved by fans of video game music today. Unfortunately, this wasn't the case at the time. If you were around for the beginning of the show, you already know. When Gimmick released, it did so to lackluster sales, and the North American arm of Sunsoft didn't even want to spend the resources bringing the game to other markets. For those who poured their efforts into this platformer, it was heartbreaking. The game's director, Tomomi Sakai, would never direct another game, and Kageyama, for all his efforts, though he would go on to compose six other games over the next decade or so, was deeply shaken by this. He had worked so hard to compose the best music he could for the game, only to have it trashed by media outlets and banished to collect dust on store shelves in the shadow of the Super Nintendo and other more modern platforms and games. Looking back on his experience, Kageyama said, quote, "Back then, composing was a surprisingly tough job. When a new title came up, I doubted if I could do it. It was always in my mind that I'd written this kind of song before, so now I had to go one better. Those doubts started to consume me. And back then, I had no idea of what people thought about my music. No feedback from the people who listened was heard. Maybe that's one of the reasons I ended up quitting," unquote. Now, Kageyama has the benefit of hindsight there, but it's true that he, like so many other great composers, was driven away from video game music. I've seen it so many times before. The unfulfilling nature of game development and the extenuating circumstances these products can sometimes find themselves victim to, it's a naturally antagonistic environment for many creative minds. So yeah, I mean, he quit. Since the 90s, though, Kageyama has continued playing the alto saxophone, and he also found time for design work, and he became a professional photographer as well. He often combines these interests by documenting the Japanese jazz music scene with his images. My understanding is that there's about a 10-year gap from 1999 to the year 2010 when Kageyama didn't compose any music at all. But when a music label by the name of City Connection expressed interest in featuring his music from Gimmick on the 2011 CD I mentioned earlier in the program, apparently the president of the company reached out to Kageyama directly and asked him to compose a remix disc for the release. As luck would have it, time had healed Kageyama's misgivings around composing game music, and he agreed to create entirely new arranged versions of two tracks from Gimmick that he had first composed nearly 20 years earlier. I have those songs ready to play for you now, and they feature the composer himself on the alto saxophone, so you can finally hear what a master he had become. One last note today, though. Kageyama has recently allied himself with Brave Wave Productions. They're a Japanese music label focusing on the connection between video games, music, and nostalgia. In his bio on their website, Kageyama declares that it is finally time for him to bring his signature jazzy style to Western audiences, and I couldn't agree more. And what better time to start than now with these two beautiful arrangements from Gimmick's classic score. You're listening to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Thank you. Thank you for listening to today's episode of Square Wave. Gimmick is such a perfect example of why I make this show. It's an obscure game filled to the brim with fantastic music that was made possible by specialized hardware and by a composer whose life happens to fit nicely into a narrative arc. If you liked the show today, you can hear all my other episodes by subscribing to the show Square Wave on your podcast platform of choice. Square Wave is written and hosted by me, Dustin Rogers. The show's theme was composed by Spaceman Fantastiques. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for more great community radio on CKUW 95.9 FM.
This is Scott from Absent Sound, but the sounds here on CKUW are very much present. Keep it locked to 95.9 FM.
Got a bike or some parts you want to put to good use? Drop them off at any of the City of Winnipeg's 4R locations on Panet, Pacific, or Brady Road during their open hours. Wrench volunteers pick up from each location at least monthly and get those bikes back on the road through education programs, community bike repair, and bike giveaways. Since 2010, Winnipeggers have helped the Wrench divert over 250,000 kilograms of bikes and parts from the landfill, ensuring that anyone who wants a bike has a bike. Let's keep rolling. For more information, visit us at thewrench.ca.
Hello, Ron Robinson here for Pages, Radio for Readers. I'm here every Thursday evening with an invitation to join me from 5 to 5:30. We'll keep you current with upcoming book events and news, author interviews in season with autographed copies to give away. Other features include what's on at Winnipeg Public Libraries, Today in Literary History, and I'll read a passage from The Diary of a Bookseller. Music as well to suit the hour and our march around the supper table. So I hope you'll bookmark our time and place on the dial. That's Pages, Radio for Readers, every Thursday evening, 5 to 5:30 on CKUW FM.
Generous support to CKUW 95.9 FM is provided by Into the Music, quality collectible music since 1987. Into the Music is located in the Exchange District, 245 McDermott at the corner of King Street. To receive our twice-weekly newsletter, call the store or go online at intothemusic.ca to sign up. Kick off your Friday evenings at 7:30 with us at our in-store stage for free all-ages shows featuring local bands and performers.